It's Thursday, the 13th of November, 2025, and you're listening to Weekly Reveille here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader and Flagstaff, Chuck Kaufman, bringing you news of interest to our veterans community here in Arizona. Today we have news from our military news website, stripes.com and militarytimes.com, as well as the publications and websites of our veterans service organizations and the Veterans Administration. Starting with our first headline, this is from stripes.com, the official website of the Stars and Stripes newspaper from the 11th of November. Veterans Day ceremony honors millions who served during World War II. Friends of the National World War II Memorial and the National Park Service on Tuesday co-hosted a Veterans Day observance at the memorial, honoring the 16 million American men and women who served in the military during the war. World War II veterans paid tributes to their fallen brothers and sisters on the cold and windy morning in Washington by placing wreaths at the memorial's Freedom Wall. It's wonderful that we've got all these people here to come and celebrate with us because each one is a little hero coming out in this cold weather, said retired Army Colonel Frank Cohn, one of the last survivors of the Battle of the Bulge, who turned 100 this year. And I appreciate all of them coming. It's a remembrance of all the people who didn't get through the war, the ones who were killed, said Cohn. We have to memorialize them because they did everything to even give their lives to the freedom that we wanted. And this is what's important. We got the freedom, and we should keep it. And everybody's got to help keep it, too. And that's Veterans Day ceremony honors millions who served during World War II. Our next article is by Svetlana Shkolnikova of Stars and Stripes from the 10th of November. Congress moves to reopen government with bill to fund VA and military construction. Congress this week is set to vote on a spending package that would reopen the government and provide full-year funding for the Department of Veterans Affairs and Pentagon construction programs that modernize facilities and build troop housing. The $153 billion legislation, one of the three fiscal 2026 spending bills lawmakers are weighing as they move to end the longest government shutdown ever, would allocate $133 billion in discretionary funding for the VA and about $20 billion for military construction. The Senate could vote on the measure, which is attached to a stopgap appropriations bill to fund the government through January 30th, as soon as Monday. The House is expected to come back from its weeks-long recess to vote on the plan on Wednesday at the earliest. If passed, the Military Construction and Veterans Affairs Appropriations Bill would also provide $263.7 billion in mandatory funding for veterans benefits, as well as $115.1 billion for veterans medical care, and an extra $52.6 billion for veterans exposed to burn pits and other toxins. The legislation includes $1.4 billion to support the construction of new VA hospitals and veterans cemeteries, as well as $19.7 billion for about 300 military construction projects in the U.S. and around the world, according to the Senate Appropriations Committee. The latter sum includes $1.9 billion for military family housing, $1.3 billion for the construction of barracks and other unaccompanied housing, and $1.3 billion for hospitals, schools, child development centers, fitness centers, dining facilities, and mess halls. More than $7 billion would also be spent on modernizing infrastructure critical to warfighter readiness, including training ranges and maintenance and logistics facilities, storage warehouses, munitions facilities, and airfield control towers. Another $2 billion would pay for infrastructure for new and emerging technology such as next-generation hangars to support advanced weapons platforms, and $482 million would cover the U.S. share of NATO construction projects. The plan also allocates $1.5 billion to the Navy's Shipyard Infrastructure Optimization Program, an initiative to refurbish four aging public shipyards in Virginia, Maine, Washington State, and Hawaii. The program is a key part of the Trump administration's efforts to boost American shipbuilding amid competition from China. Apart from construction, the Defense Department would continue to operate under fiscal 2025 spending levels through the end of January as part of the emerging deal to end the shutdown. Seven Democrats and independent Senator Angus King of Maine, who caucuses with Democrats, voted alongside Republicans to advance the agreement on Sunday in a 60-40 vote. It is unclear how the spending package will fare in the House. Representative Rosa DeLauro of Connecticut, the top Democrat on the House Appropriations Committee, said Sunday that the VA and military construction measure was an improvement over stopgap funding provided for 2025, but was released prematurely. And that's Congress moves to reopen government with bill to fund VA military construction. Our next article is by Gary Warner of Stars and Stripes from the 11th. Americans planned a massive invasion of Japan for November 1945, but it didn't happen. There are no rows of white crosses across the Satsuma Peninsula or victory memorials dotting Kagoshima Bay. No markers at beaches on Kyushu bearing names of American car brands, Buick, Cadillac, Stutz, Zephyr. And no aging veterans gather with military and political leaders to recall the grinding battle that would have brought 100,000 troops ashore. More than 14 U.S. Army and Marine divisions never landed on X day of Operation Downfall, a planned invasion of Japan to end World War II. None of it happened because of two shattering flashes of light and heat. The atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in August 1945. More than 150,000 Japanese citizens died from the blast and radiation. Some estimates say the toll is nearly twice that. Japan announced its surrender on August 15, 1945, and was made official on September 2, 1945, aboard the battleship USS Missouri in Tokyo Bay. The invasion scheduled for November 1945, 80 years ago this month, became just old maps and battle plans to file away, relics of an extended war that never was. How much longer and more deadly is still debated. The invasion would have meant millions more Americans serving in the war, marching afterward on Veterans Day. Thousands more would have been mourned on Memorial Day. I think an invasion would have been incredibly bloody and awful, said historian Jonathan Parshall during a webinar in September hosted by the National World War II Museum in New Orleans. American casualties would be horrific. Millions of Japanese civilians would have died. It would have been an absolute bloodbath. Guadalcanal, North Africa, Italy, Tarawa, Saipan, D-Day, Battle of the Bulge, Iwo Jima, and Okinawa were all preludes to final victory. Italy and Germany were defeated, but Japan still held a massive swath of Asia and the Pacific. Until mid-1945, U.S. planners expected the war to continue well into 1946. The Pentagon estimated it needed 900,000 replacement troops, 600,000 for the Army and Air Force and Army Air Forces, 300,000 for the Navy and Marines. Norman Palmer, co-author of Codename Downfall, about the plans for the invasion, said, American military leaders had to deal with an enemy that increasingly used suicide as a strategy. Beginning with the American invasion to take back the Philippines in 1944, the Japanese employed a large number of kamikaze aircraft to sink ships and kill large numbers of Americans. The threat was unexpected and difficult to counter, he said. As the invasion's time frame approached, American planners were factoring in higher casualty numbers. Kamikaze planes, kamikaze small craft, kamikaze submarines, even kamikaze civilians with explosives or just spears, Palmer said. Kill as many Americans as possible, no matter the cost to them. Downfall had two phases. Operation Olympic would launch from Okinawa to invade Kyushu in November 1945. Operation Coronet in March 1946 would invade the central island of Honshu and push across the Kanto Plain to capture Tokyo. In the initial phase, 250,000 American troops supported by land and carrier-based aircraft would face 700,000 Japanese defenders on Kyushu. The U.S. Army's 25th and 33rd Divisions would land at Miyazaki, the 1st Cavalry and 43rd Divisions at Ariake Bay. The 2nd, 3rd, and 5th Marine Divisions would target Kagoshima. The 18 landing beaches all were to be named after American car brands. By Thanksgiving, 816,000 Americans would be on Kyushu. Occupying the southern portion of the island would allow Americans to use captured airfields and build new ones. Round-the-clock bombing raids would use both heavy bombers against cities and factories, and tactical aircraft would harass rail lines, command posts, and communication centers. Japan was preparing a desperate defenses under Operation Ketsugo, or Final Battle. Troops would face fanatical resistance. Japan planned to replicate Okinawa's Operation Tengo, Tengo meaning heaven. The tactics called for suicide attacks. Japan's army and navy had as many as 10,000 aircraft ready by July 1945, most of which were used for one-way trips. Suicide attacks would come by sea, too. Shinyo motorboats, Kaiten crude torpedoes, and 400 midget submarines, more than 1,000 Fukuyu, meaning crouching dragon, divers, trained to swim at landing craft with contact mines. Civilians were urged to become 100 million shields of the emperor. Official propaganda urged the Japanese that death was preferable to defeat and capture. The second phase of the invasion, Operation Coronet, would be launched on Y Day in March. 8 Army divisions, including 2 armored, would land at Sagami Bay near Kamakura and push past Yokohama. 3 Army and 3 Marine divisions, including the 1st, 4th, and 6th, would land at the Boso Peninsula and move east toward Tokyo. Planners expected to have 1.17 million American and Allied troops on Honshu within 60 days. For the first time in the Pacific, the flat expanse of the Kanto Plain leading to Tokyo would allow for the use of armored divisions for the final drive on the imperial capital. Even when told of the atomic bomb that had been detonated in July at Alamogordo, New Mexico, many American planners did not expect the nuclear bomb would push Japan into surrender. In my opinion, there should not be the slightest thought of changing the Olympic operation, General Douglas MacArthur said. After the bombs devastated Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the invasion plans became moot. Emperor Hirohito spoke on the radio, his voice heard by citizens for the first time, to announce surrender. Estimates of the cost and lives of invading Japan remain controversial. MacArthur thought American casualties would be about 23,000. Major General Charles Willoughby projected 200,000 casualties on Kyushu and 510,000 more to capture the rest of Japan, 400,000 for Honshu alone. Former President Herbert Hoover, asked by President Harry Truman to draft post-war plans, estimated up to 1 million Americans dead and wounded. 500,000 American casualties is realistic, Palmer said. Millions of Japanese military and civilian would die. One grim calculation, the U.S. had built up a stockpile of nearly 500,000 Purple Hearts, the medal given to those wounded and the families of those killed. The post-World War II surplus meant that there were enough in warehouses run by the Defense Supply Center to last through Korea, Vietnam, the Cold War, Grenada, Panama, the Gulf War, and more minor conflicts. New medals weren't pressed until 1999 during U.S. operations in Kosovo. That's Americans Planned a Massive Invasion of Japan for November 1945, but it didn't happen. Well, let's turn now to militarytimes.com for this item. Air Force Base housing landlord shuns pre-Thanksgiving Christmas decor. This is from the 12th of November by Mike Schneider of the Associated Press and reported on MilitaryTimes.com. Outdoor Christmas decorations aren't flying at the U.S. Air Force Base housing in the Florida Panhandle, at least not before Thanksgiving. The private company that operates a community of homes near Tyndall Air Force Base recently instructed residents to remove their Yuletide decorations and refrain from putting them back up until after Turkey Day. All holiday decorations should be reflective in their respective months and not any sooner than 30 days before the given holiday, the landlord said in the message. Air Force Captain Justin Davidson Beebe, a Tyndall spokesman, said Wednesday that the landlord, Balfour Beatty Communities, had set the policy. The operations manager for the company's Tyndall Air Force Base homes didn't respond to an emailed inquiry. They're enforcing the community standards outlined in the legally binding lease agreement all residents voluntarily signed, Davidson Beebe said in an email. These guidelines are not part of a broader Air Force policy. Since community standards are set by the privatized housing management company at some installations, standards may vary from base to base. The 59-page Community Handbook for Tyndall Air Force Base Homes explicitly states that winter decorations and lights are only allowed from the week after Thanksgiving through New Year's Day, and that lights can only be lit from 7 p.m. to 11 p.m. Do not keep them lit all night or in daylight hours, the handbook says. They must be removed no later than the third week of January. They may not remain on the exterior year-round. The base, located outside Panama City in Florida's Panhandle, is home to the 325th Fighter Wing. The base suffered catastrophic damage in 2018 from Hurricane Michael, a Category 5 storm. The estimated cost to rebuild the base was $4.7 billion. And that's Air Force Base housing landlord shuns pre-Thanksgiving Christmas decor. Next, from MilitaryTimes.com, we have an article by Dave Kindy, Gunners Revives Forgotten Chapter of Air War Over Korea. This is from the 11th. Thomas Stevens' first combat mission was memorable and defied direct orders from the Commander-in-Chief. On November 28, 1952, the 19-year-old airman was a tail gunner on a Boeing B-29 Superfortress on a nighttime bombing run over North Korea. After dropping its load of 20 500-pound bombs on a target along the Yalu River, the aircraft was caught in a strong wind and blown over the border into Manchuria. President Harry S. Truman had forbidden any U.S. Air Force planes from crossing into Chinese airspace to prevent further escalation of the Korean War. However, instead of a reprimand, the crews of the 307th Bombardment Group of the 13th Air Force were treated to breakfast. Running low on gas, the squadron diverted to Japan for refueling and a meal of fresh eggs, a welcome reprieve from the powdered egg served in the unit's mess at Kadena Air Base on Okinawa. "We were not supposed to be in Manchurian airspace," Stevens, now 92 and living in Overland Park, Kansas, told Military Times. "It was something the officers laughed about, but we knew we needed to get out of there in a hurry." He added with a chuckle, "We did enjoy the breakfast." Stevens is one of five veterans featured in Gunners, B-29 Machine Gunners in the Korean War, by author and military analyst James Blackwell. The others include the late Philip Aronson, who was shot down and spent 36 months in a POW camp, Dale Crist, Romain Gregg, and Jack Bernasek, who flew the last B-29 combat mission in Korea. Blackwell conducted personal interviews and reviewed oral histories and military records of the five men in compiling this account of their service. "In many ways, Korea was the forgotten war," the author said. "This is my father's generation. They were young children during the Dust Bowl and Great Depression. They were the silent generation, as Time magazine referred to them. I wanted to write something that reflected who they were and what they went through." The new book examines a nearly forgotten chapter of the air war over Korea. With a limited number of jet bombers in service at the time, the Air Force reactivated the Superfortress to deliver payloads against enemy targets. technologically superior only a few years earlier, the slow, four-engine heavy bombers were now relics in a supersonic jet war. The B-29 against MiG-15s. It was like David and Goliath, Stevens said. It was no contest against those jet fighters. Stevens flew 27 missions over North Korea and accidentally over China. From his position as a tail gunner, he had a bird's-eye view of the results of his aircraft's bombing runs. He could also view the fighting on the ground as Marines and soldiers slugged it out with North Korean and Chinese forces. I could look down at what was happening, he recalled. I was glad I was not down there. It was no joyride in the air, either. In addition to enemy jets, superfortresses were susceptible to anti-aircraft fire. The last few minutes to the target were always the toughest. Stevens remembered hearing the deafening sound of shrapnel from exploding flak hitting and occasionally piercing the aircraft's fuselage. Made a loud bang like a car in a hailstorm, he said. There'd be little dents and holes all over the aircraft. Flak hits varied. One time was so close that it bumped me out of my seat. We had flak suits. I couldn't wear mine because of the tight space in the tail, so I put mine on the floor to help protect me. As a 19-year-old farm boy from Missouri, Stevens stated he was too young to be frightened by the danger he faced at the time. He couldn't wear a parachute because of the confines of his firing position, so he just assumed he'd go down with the plane if anything happened. When I think back now, I say, did I really do that? Was I that crazy? He stated, we had our orders and we followed them. It was an exciting time. Capable of delivering conventional and nuclear weapons, the B-29 was a modern marvel when it first flew in World War II. The high-altitude strategic bomber featured an analog computerized firing system that enabled one person to direct four remote-controlled machine gun turrets known as blisters because of the rounded plexiglass covers. If a gunner was wounded, the fire control officer could direct shooting at enemy planes at that position. Instead of firing by Kentucky windage, airmen sat in seats with a screen that showed the target and adjusted for speed, distance, and other factors. When an enemy aircraft appeared in a circle of dots, the gunner flipped a switch. It was an analog system that was essentially mechanical, so it didn't have the speed of a modern computer, Blackwell said. It was designed for shooting down German and Japanese fighters. It was a little slow against jets, but still did a good job. Blackwell began researching the book, believing the slower superfortress was overmatched by a faster Soviet Union jet flown in the Chinese and North Korean air forces. However, he found that premise to be not quite true. I'd heard stories and came to this with the impression that the B-29s were obsolete and outclassed in the Korean War, he said. After checking the statistics, I came to a different conclusion and changed my approach to writing the book. While the propeller-driven heavy bombers were outpaced by enemy jets, they managed to hold their own in combat. Blackwell's analysis of statistics showed the superfortress was at a definite disadvantage in the early days of the Korean War. When the Air Force was flying daytime missions using World War II formations. However, Air Command changed tactics and had the B-29s fly only at night while making single-file bombing runs. By the end of the war, B-29s had shot down 25 MiG-15s compared to 16 bombers lost to enemy jets. The Air Force flipped the trend by adopting new techniques, Blackwell said. Ending daytime missions was critical because MiG-15s weren't equipped for nighttime attacks. Flying single file on bombing runs also reduced losses. In addition, our gunnery training outpaced that of the enemy, enabling the B-29s to stay ahead of the enemy jets in terms of kills. Since Stevens flew only night missions, he rarely saw MiG-15s chasing his superfortress. In fact, he did not use his two 50-caliber machine guns against a threat. I never fired them in combat, he said, only test-fired them at the start of missions. After Korea, Stevens left the Air Force as a staff sergeant in 1955. He married and raised two sons while attending college on the GI Bill. He then joined Southwestern Bell Telephone Company, retiring as a district manager after 33 years. However, Stevens' work was not done. 2006, he helped build and dedicate the Korean War Veterans Memorial Park in his retirement community of Overland Park, Kansas. In 2010, he was elected to the National Board of the Korean War Veterans Association, serving eventually as president. In that role, he championed the cause of Korean War vets in meetings with President Barack Obama and Vice President Mike Pence, as well as other government officials. Today, Stevens continues to speak to school groups and others about the forgotten war and the sacrifices made by the men and women who served in the conflict. He is especially proud of his time in the Air Force and all he learned as an airman. "It was an invaluable experience that helped shape the rest of my life," he said. Blackwell hopes his book informs readers of the debt they owe Korean War veterans. On his speaking tour, he gives away free copies of his book to veterans so they never forget the people who came before them. "Korean War vets have the same needs and hurts as the veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan," he said. "We need to sit and listen to what they have to say, too." And that's Gunners, Revive's forgotten chapter of air war over Korea. We return to Stripes.com for this item by Yoonjin Lee from the 7th of November. Retired Army officer honors her great-grandfather and UN troops at key Korean battlefield. The great-granddaughter of U.S. Army General Matthew Ridgway recently visited South Korea to see the place where United Nations troops waged a desperate fight to finally halt a Chinese counteroffensive nearly 75 years ago. Julie McKnight, a retired Army lieutenant colonel, toured Chipyongni, where U.S. and French troops under United Nations command held off waves of Chinese attacks February 13th through the 15th, 1951. Her great-grandfather at the time, commander of 8th Army, ordered the U.S. 23rd Regimental Combat Team, along with the French, to hold the vital crossroads village and halt the Chinese army advance. UN troops, surrounded and outnumbered 5-1, held on for 3 days, according to U.S. Army account of the fight. "It's been amazing to be able to come here," McKnight said Tuesday during a tour of the Chipyongni Battle Memorial about 40 miles east of Seoul. "I've been fascinated by my great-grandfather since I was a little girl, so it's really cool to see firsthand his impacts here in Korea." McKnight, the following day in Seoul, accepted the Korean-American Friendship Award from the Korea-America Association, given posthumously to her great-grandfather. "It is because of General Ridgway's legacy that I'm standing here today as an Army veteran myself, having completed just shy of 21 years active duty when I retired a few months ago," she said at the gathering inside the Plaza Hotel. "I don't think the idea of Army service ever would have entered my head had I been not so fascinated with him as a child." Chipyongni marked the first time UN troops managed to stop the Chinese advance into South Korea since October 19, 1950, when the Chinese crossed the Yalu River boundary and overwhelmed UN forces. 2 months after Chipyongni, Ridgway succeeded General Douglas MacArthur, relieved by President Harry Truman as commander of the UN forces. In the following spring of 1952, he replaced Dwight D. Eisenhower as Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, followed by his appointment as Army Chief of Staff from August 1953 to June 1955. He died in July 1993 at age 98. "He was a leader who cared about his troops, someone who led from the front," McKnight said during her award speech. "May the friendship cemented between our two peoples continue to grow over the next 75 years and beyond." McKnight was 11 when her great-grandfather died, and she never got to meet him, she said at the ceremony. "One of my favorite things to do in grade school whenever I visited a library was to pull up the R volume of the encyclopedia and find his name," she said. "Back then, the internet a decade or more away, research required diligence. If you were in the encyclopedia, it was a really big deal." And that's retired Army officer honors her great-grandfather, UN troops, at key Korean battlefield. You're listening to Weekly Reveille here on Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. I'd like to remind you that you can listen to Weekly Reveille and other Sun Sounds of Arizona programming, either as it streams or at a time of your choosing, by going to the Sun Sounds of Arizona website at sunsounds.org or by downloading the Sun Sounds of Arizona app, available for your Android phone or tablet from the Google Play Store or your Apple phone or tablet from the Apple App Store. And you can listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona streaming on your Amazon Dot, Echo, or Show. Returning to Stripes.com, we have this movie announcement. Trials of Nazis were proud moment in U.S. military history, film director says, ahead of premiere. This article is by Matthew M. Burke of Stars and Stripes from the 6th of November. Grafenwehr, Germany. The 13-year filmmaking journey that director James Vanderbilt undertook for his latest movie at times seemed as impossible as the events it conveys were deemed to be. But Nuremberg set to premiere Friday in stateside and U.S. military base theaters the odyssey to bring author Jack L. Hai's book, The Nazi and the Psychiatrist, to the silver screen is almost at an end. Both recount the story of an Army doctor who evaluated captured Nazi leaders ahead of the Nuremberg trials, a watershed in war crimes accountability that got underway 80 years ago this month. One of the things that was incredible for me that I discovered during my research is I thought the trials were kind of a foregone conclusion, Vanderbilt said in an interview Monday. Our film talks a lot about how hard it was to make those trials happen, how potentially dangerous it could have been to have given these men another platform on the world stage, but also how important it was to put them on trial to get on record the types of crimes that they committed. It was an all-star cast featuring Russell Crowe playing Hermann Goering, the Nazi of the book title, and Rami Malek as psychiatrist Lieutenant Colonel Douglas Kelly. The film is slated to premiere at 7 p.m. Friday at Ramstein Air Base's KMCC Theater and will continue across Germany in the coming days, said Chris Ward, a spokesman for the Army and Air Force Exchange Service. The first showing in Bavaria is planned for Saturday at Grafenwehr's Tower Barracks and a screening at U.S. Army Garrison Ansbach, just 25 miles southwest of Nuremberg, will take place Sunday at 6 p.m. Vanderbilt said he made the movie to honor the men and women who fought in World War II and then had to secure the peace. He also wanted to make sure that the lessons of the past are not forgotten. We worked really hard to be as accurate as possible, he said. I hope we did you proud because I think this is a really proud moment in the history of the U.S. military and of our country. Held in the title city's Palace of Justice, the Nuremberg trials began November 20, 1945, 3 months after the U.S., France, the Soviet Union, and the United Kingdom signed a charter creating an international military tribunal to try German leaders. 22 top Nazi officials stood trial on charges of crimes against humanity, war crimes, and others. Defendants included Goering, Hitler's deputy, Deputy Leader of the Nazi Party, Rudolf Hess, Admiral Karl Dönitz, and the Governor General of Occupied Poland, Hans Frank. Proceedings included testimony and film shot by U.S. soldiers liberating concentration camps. After the verdicts on October 1, 1946, a dozen of the defendants were sentenced to death. Goering died by suicide using cyanide the night before his execution. The film was shot in Hungary, but the courtroom was replicated to the inch using the actual building plans, Vanderbilt said. Nuremberg starts on the day of Germany's initial surrender, May 7, 1945. Kelly thinks he's going home, but is instead sent to evaluate members of the Nazi high command, including Goering. The film also centers on U.S. Supreme Court Justice Robert Jackson, played by Michael Shannon, who lobbied for the criminal proceedings and served as the chief American prosecutor in the Nuremberg trials. Crowe signed on in 2019, which really propelled the production forward and attracted more acclaimed cast members and financiers, Vanderbilt said. He described the Oscar-winning Crowe's three-dimensional performance as chilling. In a conversation with podcaster Joe Rogan on Wednesday, Crowe talked about the nuance of the role of Goering. A lot of things in this story are way bigger than what we know and commonly understand, Crow said. That's what I was looking for, to try and find a way to understand his base motivations. Nuremberg is not holding any events related to the film premiere, but is planning to use its release to draw attention to the city's historical significance, said municipal tourism spokeswoman Franziska Steyer. Officials are also planning a slate of 80th anniversary events, including guided tours, lectures, and panel discussions from November 20th through the 23rd, city spokesman Andreas Frankes added. A release date for the movie in Germany has not been determined. Some other European countries that have a significant U.S. military presence do have premieres of the film upcoming. The U.K. on November 14th, Poland on November 28th, and Italy on December 18th. Vanderbilt also emphasized the repercussions of the Nuremberg trials, saying that without them, it may have been easier to excuse or deny Nazi war crimes. There are a lot of lessons that came out of that period of time where everybody kind of came together to choose justice over vengeance and do the right thing, he said. Stars and Stripes reporter Marcus Kluckner contributed to this report for Trials of Nazis Were Proud Moment in U.S. Military History, film director says, ahead of premiere. I did a little research on this. It does not appear to be streaming at the present time, but it will be available in theaters in the U.S. Our next item is from the VFW magazine for November and December. From their Better Health column, loss of hearing is a social and cognitive challenge. Hearing loss can contribute to dementia as it negatively impacts brain health and human connections. This is by Janice Phelan. With the link between dementia and hearing loss gaining more attention in recent years, it is increasingly important for older adults to promptly address hearing challenges. The CEO and founder of Audion Hearing knows all too well the impact of this health condition on both the person suffering from hearing loss as well as their loved ones. My grandfather suffered from pretty significant hearing loss, Ishan Patel said. When I was a kid, it just destroyed my relationship with him. I thought that Grandpa didn't like me and he didn't want to be around me, or that maybe I was annoying to him. He was basically a dead man walking. He's in the room, but he's in the back of the room, and he's staying away. His smile is empty. I watched it hurt everything in his life. When the family finally obtained hearing aids for him, Patel's grandfather's life significantly improved. Patel later co-founded Audion, a company that launched the first $98 over-the-counter hearing aid that can be accessed online as well as at Walmart, CVS, and Walgreens. Around 26% of Audion's customers are veterans, she added. Our goal is to make this help affordable and accessible for everyone, Patel said. We're on this earth to connect with each other and love each other, and we want to maintain our brains and have a good quality of life, to have independence, to have free will. According to Johns Hopkins University, older adults who have an increased risk of dementia may be able to decrease their risk of cognitive decline by nearly half with hearing aids. With around two-thirds of Americans over 70 impacted by hearing loss, treating this health issue is essential and comes at no risk, added Johns Hopkins experts. Officials from Johns Hopkins also shared several major theories regarding the link between dementia and hearing loss. These include a lack of social engagement when hearing is diminished, often resulting in individuals being withdrawn and lonely. The loss of hearing also can result in the brain failing to receive a clear sound from the ears so that it must compensate by reallocating resources at the expense of other brain functions. In addition, reduced auditory stimulation can negatively impact the brain's structural integrity and cause portions of the brain to atrophy more rapidly. Three symptoms of hearing loss are especially noticeable, Patel said, including asking others to repeat themselves or telling people they're mumbling, along with having your television volume set too high. The third sign is as simple as having loved ones tell you that you can't hear. Addressing hearing loss is key to brain health and also is critical when it comes to making meaningful connections with others. It's not just a medical challenge, it's a social and cognitive challenge, Patel said. This is the stuff life is made of, the meaning of life, to connect and love each other. This is the difference between being able to feel like a full human who gets to love and connect, or to feel like you're just being left alone, kind of on the sidelines. Janice Phelan, our author, is a freelance writer from Lee Summit, Missouri. That article, Loss of Hearing is a Social and Cognitive Challenge. Just as an aside, I have had hearing aids now for several years, and at my age, not too strange, and having flown jets, also not too strange. But after being evaluated by the VA, I was told that my hearing was not sufficiently diminished to require hearing aids, even though I was wearing them, which I thought was kind of strange. So my advice would be, keep pressing the VA if you have an opportunity. When you get them from the VA, they will not be $98. They will be top-of-the-line hearing aids and well worth the time. And they make a significant difference in my life, and particularly in relations with my spouse. The screaming across the house, what did you say, can really get on people's nerves, and the hearing aids make a significant difference. Well, let's turn now to news from the Veterans Administration, and we'll start with a newsletter from the Phoenix VA Healthcare System, Veterans News Now. And under their recent events, they have construction at Carl T. Hayden VA Medical Center. If you wondered what's happening between the main hospital tower and the ambulatory care center on Indian School Road, this is a large construction project that is underway, which will become our new Sterile Processing Service, or SPS, building. This is the first construction project to add space in quite a few years, and it's making outstanding progress. This building will have a tremendous impact for Phoenix veterans. Our current SPS team does an amazing job supporting our operating room, but they only have 7,000 square feet to work in. This is very undersized for how busy we are. The new building will provide 20,000 square feet, nearly triple the amount of space for this important work. This will also double the number of sterilizers from 2 to 4, meaning there will be space for more surgical instruments to be processed for surgical to use. The extra space will help with storage, processing, flow, and so much more. We started this project about a year ago, and we expect it to open in 2026. And they announced the Bookmobile returns to the Phoenix VA. The Phoenix Public Library Bookmobile made its monthly stop at the Carl T. Hayden VA Medical Center on November the 4th with books of all shapes, sizes, and genres for Phoenix VA healthcare system veterans, family members, and staff. The Bookmobile has been making regular stops here for 5 months now, and every time it brings books and creates smiles. Allison Sinclair, a U.S. Navy veteran and a Phoenix VA staff member, came to get a library card and left with a book to read. I have never had a library card here in Arizona, said Sinclair. I've been here since 93 and don't have a card. All I read is nonfiction, and I found a New York Times bestseller. The staff from the Phoenix Public Library are always glad to come and help veterans and staff find the books they want, whether it's to learn more about a subject of interest or simply to borrow a good book to read at home after a long day. They can even help you get your very own Phoenix Public Library card so you can keep coming back for more. Next, happy birthday, Marine Corps. On November 10th, 2025, Marines around the world took a moment to reflect, commemorate, and celebrate 250 years of winning our nation's battles. Our Corps has never been stronger than it is today because of the Marines who wear our eagle, globe, and anchor with pride. Once a Marine, always a Marine. Semper Fidelis, and happy birthday. Next, National Native American Heritage Month, which is November, Phoenix VA will be holding 2 in-person Native American Heritage Month events in November for veterans, families, caregivers, and Phoenix VA employees. First, the Native American Heritage Month Closing Day Ceremony. That'll be Wednesday, November the 20th, from 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. at the Carl T. Hayden VA Medical Center Canteen patio. The purpose? Highlight and wrap up what the Special Emphasis Program did throughout the month of November, as well as to have cultural performances and participation from tribal veterans organizations and facility partners. Second will be the Tribal Veterans Affairs Networking and Outreach Day. That'll be on the 25th of November, Thursday, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. Again, at the Carl T. Hayden VA Medical Center, this time at the ACC hallway. Purpose, to meet, network, and engage with 10 Tribal Nations Veterans Affairs officers, as well as an opportunity to resource, share, strengthen relationships, learn of shared goals and missions, and work to identify gaps and changes in services for veterans. In addition, the Phoenix VA will also have cultural entertainment. And another reminder for the November 15th, 4th Annual Vets Giving. This will be from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Entertainment, food, music, games, giveaway, and family fun. Bring your veteran ID, retired ID, or DD-214 to enter the veteran giveaways. This will be at the Carl T. Hayden VA Medical Center, 650 East Indian School Road in Phoenix. North parking lot, 7th Street at the VA Medical Center entrance. Join us for the 4th Annual Vets Giving Celebration. Families are welcome. There's a Veterans Stand Down. This is going to be hosted by Post 35 Entities, and this is Saturday, December the 13th, from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. Done by the Matthew B. Wan, American Legion Post 35, 2240 West Chandler Boulevard, Chandler, Arizona, and bring your DD-214 or VA ID card. The VA, Phoenix VA is also offering flu shots for Phoenix VA veterans. Get your flu shot today, it says. November and October, November flu clinics be on the first floor ambulatory care clinic, the ACC South Entrance, from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays. It will be closed on Thanksgiving Day. They say, get your flu shot. They're administering the flu shots 3 days a week, as I mentioned, on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays. And also, the influenza vaccine is also available at outpatient primary care locations. And that's some of the information available from the Phoenix VA Healthcare System newsletter, Veterans News Now. Now we have the Southern Arizona Veterans Health Update newsletter, and they have a Veterans Day message. They want to honor all who served. Dear veteran, on behalf of the Southern Arizona VA Healthcare System, we'd like to express our heartfelt appreciation for your service and sacrifice to our nation this Veterans Day. We're truly grateful to you for your bravery and dedication in protecting the freedoms we all hold dearly. We'll never forget the price that you've paid for our freedom. We also recognize the sacrifices made by your families and loved ones while you were serving our country. Southern Arizona VA Healthcare System is committed to providing high-quality healthcare services when veterans enter our doors. You've sacrificed so much for us, and now it is our turn to serve you. It is an honor and privilege for us to serve veterans, their families, and caregivers. We provide veterans with healthcare services at 10 locations in Southern Arizona. Facilities include our Tucson VA Medical Center and 7 community-based outpatient clinics and 3 rural health coordination centers in Casa Grande, Green Valley, Safford, Sierra Vista, Tucson, and Yuma. Veterans can make appointments or register for care here, and that's at www.va.gov/southern-arizona-health-care/locations. Additionally, VA offers 24/7 confidential crisis support for veterans and their loved ones. You don't have to be enrolled in VA benefits or health care to connect. Dial 988 and then press 1, or for more information, visit www.veterancrisisline, and that's all one word, veteranscrisisline.net. Thank you for your service. Sincerely, Maria T. Nguyen, Interim Director, Interim Chief Executive Officer of the Southern Arizona VA Healthcare System. They have a Veteran Health Fair. This will be tomorrow, November the 14th, from 1 a.m. to 1 p.m. Are you a veteran patient? Join us to learn about the healthcare services offered at Southern Arizona VA Healthcare System. And that will be at the Tucson VA Medical Center in the Rose Garden Courtyard, located at 3601 South 6th Avenue, Tucson, Arizona, to learn about the healthcare services offered at the Southern Arizona VA Healthcare System. Veteran Health Seminar. If you'd like to participate in a Veterans Health Seminar on Friday, November 14th from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m., please call 520-792-1450, extension 12985, with your name and date of birth. The seminar will focus on health and wellness activities and information. Space is limited, so you need to call today to reserve your spot at the Veteran Health Seminar. And again, that number, 520-792-1450, extension 12985. From 9 to 9:15 is a welcome. 9:15 to 9:30 is a veteran panel testimonial. 9:30 to 10, the importance of balance. 10 to 10:30, negative effects of sugar. 10:30 to 10:40 is a break. And then 10:40 to 11, breathing exercise. 11 to 11:30, mindfulness. 11:30 to 11:45, a veteran testimonial. 11:45 to 12:15, break. Noon to 12:30 is yoga practice. 12:30 p.m. to 12:45, pharmacy, how to refill your medications, and then 12:45 to 1 will be closing statements. You can join them for an engaging day focused on health and wellness, gain valuable insights, participate in wellness activities, and hear inspiring testimonials from fellow veterans. The Southern Arizona VA Healthcare System, Great American Smokeout. Join us for a Great American Smokeout health event to discover effective strategies to quit smoking. The health event will be Thursday, November 20th, 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Tucson VA Building 80 in the lobby, 3601 South 6th Avenue in Tucson. Join us for the Great American Smokeout on Thursday, November 20th, 8 to 2 in the Building 80 lobby at the Tucson VA Medical Center. There will be information to discover effective strategies to quit smoking. Pinal County 2025 13th Annual Veteran Stand Down and Resource Fair. That will be held on Saturday, November the 15th at the HOHP Veteran Transition Center. That's 5497 West McCartney Road, Coolidge, Arizona, from 9 to 1. Registration opens at 8 a.m. There will be VA benefits assistance, MVD services, IDs and driver's licenses, housing and clothing assistance, Pinal County Veterans Court, substance abuse assistance, pet care and youth activities, haircuts and showers, special women veteran services, employment training opportunities, and much, much more. The opening ceremony for veterans is at 9 a.m. And again, that's at 5497 West McCartney Road, Coolidge, Arizona, this Saturday at 9 a.m. And those are the announcements from the Southern Arizona Veterans Health Update newsletter. Now we have this item from news.va.gov. VA driver rehabilitation programs restore independence for veterans. And this is from the 30th of September, by Roderick R. Cunningham, Communications Specialist, Chief James A. Halley, Veterans Hospital. For Operation Iraqi Freedom veteran Trevero Wilson, The road to recovery meant more than medical care. It meant regaining the ability to drive. Paralyzed from the chest down after a 2005 combat injury, Wilson worked with specialists at James A. Halley Veterans Center in Tampa, Florida, to train on adaptive driving systems through VA's Driver Rehabilitation Program. That's available at www.rehab.gov/PMRS/drivers_rehabilitation_program.asp. That's a heck of a link, but if you go to news.va.gov and search for health, you'll find this article on the rehabilitation program. Being able to drive again means everything to me, Wilson shared. It gives me the freedom to go where I want, when I want, without relying on anyone else. It's a game changer. Wilson's training included advanced driving simulators, customized equipment evaluations, and hands-on instruction in modified vehicles, preparing him to operate a truck equipped with adaptive technology. For him, driving again isn't just about mobility, it's about confidence and independence. Wilson's story reflects the broader reach of VA's driver rehabilitation programs, which serve veterans and service members across the country. Since their beginnings in 1946 and with a congressional mandate in 1975, these programs have grown into a network of 50 sites nationwide offering three levels of care. Basic programs provide driver evaluations and training using simple adaptive aids. Low-tech programs introduce mechanical adaptive controls to help veterans with mobility limitations. And high-tech programs integrate cutting-edge computerized systems into vehicles for veterans with complex needs. VA also hosts the National Driver Rehabilitation Training Course, ensuring that physical medicine and rehabilitation, or PM&R, therapists across the system are trained in the latest adaptive driving technologies. These efforts are further supported by the VA Automobile Adaptive Equipment Benefit Program, which helps eligible veterans fund necessary vehicle modifications. Together, these resources ensure veterans can continue their journeys confidently and safely. For Wilson and thousands of other veterans, VA's driver rehabilitation programs represent far more than vehicle modifications. They fulfill a renewed sense of independence, dignity, and the ability to live life on their own terms. And that's VA Driver Rehabilitation Programs Restore Independence for Veterans. Well, that brings this week's edition of Weekly Reveille to a close. This is your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman, reminding you you can listen to Weekly Reveille and other Sun Sounds of Arizona programming as it streams or at a time of your choosing by going to the Sun Sounds of Arizona website at sunsounds.org, downloading the Sun Sounds of Arizona app from the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store, or you can listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona streaming on your Amazon Dot, Echo, or Show.